Now last night, we dealt with verses 1 to 4, a call to unity. Then from verse 5 onward, we noted that the rest of the chapter was devoted to the mind of Christ. Last night we dealt with the mind of Christ exhibited in the Lord himself. Verses 5 to 11. Now the rest of the chapter is the same. Verses 12 to 16, the mind of Christ exhibited in the assembly at Philippi. It reads like this. Further, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my arms, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God which worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. Do all things without murmuring and disputing, that ye may be blameless and happy, the sons of God without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation or generation, among whom ye shine as light in the world, holding forth the word of life, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I have not run in vain, neither labor in vain. The mind of Christ exhibited in the assembly at Philippi. Now verses 17 and 18. The mind of Christ seen in the Apostle Paul. Yea, and if I be offered upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I joy and rejoice with you all. For the same cause also do ye joy and rejoice with me. The mind of Christ seen in Paul. Verses 19 to 24, the mind of Christ displayed in Timothy. Read like this. But I trust in the Lord Jesus to send Timotheus, shortly unto you, that I also may be of good comfort when I know your state. For I have no man like-minded who will naturally care for your state. For all seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ. But ye know the proof of him, that as a son with the Father, he hath served with me in the gospel. Him therefore I hope to send presently, so soon as I shall see how it will go with me. But I trust in the Lord, that I also myself shall come shortly. The mind of Christ displayed in Timothy. Finally, verses 25 to 30, the mind of Christ displayed in Epaphroditus. Yet I suppose it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother, companion in labor, and fellow soldier, but your messenger, and he that ministers to my want. For he longed after you all, and was full of pity, because he had heard that he had been sick. For indeed, he was sick nigh unto death. But God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but on me also. I should have sorrow upon sorrow. I sent him therefore the more cheerfully, the more diligently, quickly, that when ye see him again, ye may rejoice, that I may be the less sorrow. Receive him therefore in the Lord with all gladness, and hold such in reputation, because for the works of Christ he was nigh unto death, not regarding his works, to supply your lack of service to follow.
truth.
Last night, we dealt with the early parts of the chapter, in which we saw that Paul was calling for oneness, for holiness, for a concern for us. Then we took time to detail that amazing passage from F5:8, in which we see Christ coming from Godhead glory, laying aside the insignia of his presence, and coming down to where he went. He came in the form of a servant, the reality of his man. He became in the likeness of men, the uniqueness of man. He was found in fashion as a man, the acceptability of his man. And then, as a man, down here on earth, he humbled himself and became obedient right on to death, even the death of the cross. And we have quite a number of testimonies to say about the mind of Christ in each one of us. That mind that is prepared to sacrifice our life for others. Prepared to go out of our way to help other people. Not so much living here to follow a course for ourselves, but just to sacrifice ourselves. Two things coming in through the today. Not so often mentioned. This theme of sacrificial living. This challenge to unity and oneness amongst you. You can't say that at night. We'll need to be. That life should not be as comfortable. And separation, division amongst us should not be every time for peace. It is all on the whole a betrayal of the purity of divine truth. So the day of account coming for it all, friends. While I know that in many places and countries things have been inherited from previous generations, nevertheless, the present application in all its pertinence of divine truth must be based on by every generation. You must live this, your life for his glory, or pay the price to be able to do. And you can make the choice. You can make something of that. You can be big or small. I don't mean to say a big public man or anything like that, but just where you are, you can live your life and give it for God and Christ, we see tonight, in local services. We got down just to the opening of verse 9, Lord exalted Christ. You see, the man that humbled himself, God exalted. The man that didn't try to cut a name for himself, God gave him a name above every name. The man that bowed his knee in lowly service to others, God has decreed that every knee shall bow to him. The man who used his tongue to pour out greater thoughts of compassion and rebuke, then God has decreed that every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Don't argue about the Bible. God never gave you the Bible to argue about. Whether you think the name above every name is Jesus, or whether you think that it's Jehovah, or whether you think, like the present speaker, that it's the name of an owl, whatever it may be, let this be sure, that God has decreed that the day is coming, when everyone in the universe shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. That is not primarily salvation, that's subjugation. Every being, notice verse 10, that every being in heaven, earth, and under the earth shall confess his name. Every being in heaven, celestial realm. Every being on earth, terrestrial realm. Every being under the earth, the infernal realm. The whole of the universe shall unite to be tribute to Christ, and whether they are rebels to all eternity, everyone shall report to the faith. That which is the theme of the gospel. That Jesus Christ is Lord.
and all to the ultimate glory of God the Father. You may be a reproach for a month. One day the whole universe will confess the name of the one who gave up. Now, in that silence, in our room, in order to show how this mind of Christ can be manifested in a local assembly, in verses 12 and 13, he is dealing with working out what he calls salvation. And in verses 14 to 16, he's telling us how we can shine and see. Amen. And with us now, therefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only when I was with you, but now in my absence when I am no longer with you, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. That's the inward thing, for it is God which worketh in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure. Now, and that's right. The normal expectation is that here in verse 12, you're working out the salvation that you've got in us. That's it pertains to your testimony. And you'll work that out in your life into holiness and reverential fear of God. Now, of course, that is true. I will teach. I think the effect of salvation here is assembly salvation. I think it's dealing with assembly problems. So the thing is, you've got your problems in God's heart. How is that? When I was with you, I was able to help. Apostolic wisdom was available to you, and now I'm asking. And we are in the same position then as the Philippians. Apostolic wisdom is no longer with us unless we are inspired by it. We are living in days when there are no apostles that fight all faith. There were only 13 apostles directly commissioned by Christ, and every one of them has seen Christ. There are no others. Jesus 2 verse 20 is perfectly clear. The foundation of the church was built upon the ministry of apostles and prophets in that order. They were in the foundation and laid the foundation. They are not in the 20th verse. Come that please. So that I think that in that sense, he's saying now that you'll need to work out your own prophets. This will be to your salvation and benefit. Work out your assembly salvation of all the problems. Work out. Work out. Don't go away. Don't put your head in the sand. You need to work out. And he says, you can work out this salvation with fear and trembling. With fear, lest in any way you displease the Lord. Trembling as you recognize the awesome majesty of the Lord of the assembly. Whether you believe that's what the passage teaches in the assembly of faith, that you've got to work it out. You've got to handle it. And you've got to handle it in fear and trembling, not arrogantly. Not laying down the law, but with the fear of God in your soul. Because, as I said another thing, when it's the first night on bishops and deacons over here and seven, ultimately and finally, any decision by an assembly we are claiming that's the decision for all of us. We act for him. Now he said, power is available for you. That's the great thing. God would never ask you to do a thing without giving power to do it. He says it is God that worketh in you, both to will and to do his good pleasure. So that even in assembly matter, the good pleasure of the Lord is before you. Power, internal power will be granted to you to do it for God's glory. It's God that works. It's the internal operation of divine power by the Spirit that will enable you to work out your assembly problems for the pleasure of God and for the delight of God. Work out the rules. Sit down to it and solve your own problems. That means, look now at that 14th city. In all this, you don't do it by murmurings and disputes. Do you not? No murmuring. No mutterings. No wrangling. No disputing. No arguments. No coming together in your little groups, as I said the other night, and feeding on each other's resentment against someone or someone. These are the things that destroy assembly life, making assembly problems difficult. Breaking up the little in little groups, in which you all agree on certain things, and you keep that resentment in each other. Terrible. You think these things were never in your life? All things are those murmurings and disputes. That's to see what you are. You're blameless. You're harmless. You're without fault. Now notice these, will you, central to it all, you are the sons of God. You are the children of God. I never forget that. You are those who represent God. He's given you dignity and status. He should always remember in every situation, and especially in your local assembly, that you are there as the sons of God. And you're there to represent God. You are not a family church, wherever you are. You never were asked to represent President or any other instance. You used to represent Godhead. So get your dignity here. And remember, they may call you all kinds of brethren and give you names. Remember, please, we are the sons of God. That's our dignity. We never attained to that. God made us last night we were converted. Now he says, I've made you that, you be that. So as the sons of God, we don't murmur and dispute. He says, you are the people that are blameless. Now that doesn't mean to say you're perfect or you're sinless. But we are a blameless person is one against whom no charge can be laid. We are irreproachable. We're not perfect, but we're blameless. You can't find sin in us. We are harmless. We are guileless. We are pure. No impure motives. No guile. No planning to undermine something or be against someone. We are without rebuke, we are without fault. We are people who live like the sons of God. Have you got the idea? It's clear. He says, clear then. For he says you're living in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. That world outside. Now you be careful about your contacts with it. but it bends. It twisted. It's crooked. Thoughts straight up and down. They're not backed by righteousness. It fell there. It's perverted. It's depraved. It's sinful. Unless you have to do with it the best. And unless you have to do with the ungodly the best, they are entirely opposite of what they are. You see? When you get a person who is blameless and guileless and how costly that is, friends, I'm listening. Don't you think that your friends are the friends that tell you the things you want to hear? Invariably, these are not your friends. You think they are. Your real friends are the friends that tell you the truth. Whether it hurts or not, that's your real friend. You believe these nonsense. I know it's not true to the way we go on, but that's true. Your real friends are the friends that will take your side and tell you kindly, absolutely, he won't try to feed your pride and your ego and tell you the things that you know you want to say. In fact, I have found in life very often the best friends are the friends who will say, I was in the wrong group and doing the wrong. That's true. So here we are. Just planted where we are in our own Philippi. In our own locality. We are the people. We are blameless. Animals. Without fault. Now watch now. Photograph 15. And we are the people who shine as stars, as luminaries in the world. Now think of it. Think of the answer tonight. It's dark. Or it's lit up, and the neon lights are flashing. But in the eyes of God, it is dark. It's black. And the sons of God are shining. And the lampstands are giving the light to local assemblies. We are shining as lights and luminaries. In the darkness of this world, lighting it up as we go through, you see, if that is true, then it means you would recognize every Christian for their light. That is the other side. That would have been right. God doesn't want to help you. We're not like them. And we don't want to be like them. And we don't want their company. And we don't want their fellowship. But we'll spare them. For the last drop of our blood to help. We'll be friendly, but they're not our friends. Light and darkness. And Lord, as we see, you not only shine, but you see. You live. You're holding forth the word of light. We shine in our lives and speak with our lips. Isn't that right? You believe in the living light, don't you? You believe in the impact of consecrated personality. And you believe in the power of the spoken word, don't you? The word of life is awesome. He says, holding forth the word of life, watch now. So, if you live like that, because I have spent so much labor on you, you are saved through my preaching. I saw you baptized, I saw you gathered. I want you to live as you ought to live. And he says, if you do that, he says, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ at the judgment seat, that I have not run in vain nor labored in vain. That all the expenditure of life and strength and energy and talent has not been in vain. Because you've lived as a Christian for you see, there is a day of account coming, dear friend. Everything will need to be done at 10 o'clock. Maybe you don't like the preachers that tell you the things you shouldn't do. I can tell you in that day, you'll realize you need to be right. You maybe don't care for it straight from the shoulder. I tell you in that day, if you listen and believe and live, you'll bow at that just as me. You'll be crowned by Christ. Paul says, I rejoice in that day, because I haven't believed what it's been. Tell me. Why do you think that I would say to you, I'm expecting results from these meetings and so on? I'm not teaching the gospel, I'm teaching what the Lord I expect from. Lives to be changed. Character to be molded. Of our consecration now, the past is over with. I'm finished with it. I'm on to God.
I told you before, you'll lose a few friends. Some Christians are not too good company.
Beware of the half-hearted ones.
No desire for the work of God. That's why you don't see them here very much. You don't want to be old. God bless your assembly. But remember, this is the mind of Christ operating. But with Christ, and through here he was different. He spoke out. All the time he was pouring out his soul unto him. Sacrifice.
Chapter 17 and 18. One about Paul, a different picture of the three principles of sacrifice.
Chapter 17.
Paul says, he and if I be poured forth as a thank offering, upon the sacrificial service of your faith, I joy and rejoice with you all. Chapter 18, mutual joy. For the same reason, we joy and rejoice with thee. Now please, in verse 17, now we're going to look at two offerings. We're going to look at the drink offering, and we're going to look at the pan. Strange, you say? And you will notice, please, that here, Paul likens himself to a drink offering. Literally, if I be poured out as a libation, if I give myself as a drink offering. Now you go back to your Old Testament and read it, and you'll find that a man would come with a burnt offering. He would offer it to God. But then with it he would pour out a drink offering. That drink offering would express his joy and delight in God. Symbolic of a life poured out to please God. You say, what's the burnt offering? Well, look at it now. He says, I'm prepared to pour out my life as a drink offering upon the sacrificial service of your faith. What's that? Well, here's an amazing thing. The sacrifice and service of their faith, the Philippians' faith, the assembly faith, the sacrificial service is the collective activities of the local assembly at Philippi. Right? That's the burnt offering. Now watch now. We'll see this later in chapter 4. He used the assembly at Philippi as a company of priest offering a burnt offering. That burnt offering is their service for God. You see, when you go to your Old Testament, a priest was an intelligent person who considered the results for God. Everything that a priest did, he did for God.
In so doing, you bless men. So here is all the activity that you go in for, Sunday schools, etc., whatever you may do. It's a burnt offering going up to God. It's your sacrificial service. That service is looked upon as a burnt offering ascending to God, giving Him pleasure and delight. Paul said, listen, I'm prepared to stand beside that and give my life for it. Is that right? Tell me now. Come on.
What are you younger folks doing? Are you doing anything for God in your assembly? Or are you keeping out and you're not responsible? That means that you don't need to always be there. Come on.
Paul says, I'm prepared to give my life for that.
It is 21 years. Just now at Easter, since my third came to Toronto. West Indies. That I think of certain assemblies in this area as I do in other areas around the world. When I think of certain assemblies, I think of certain brethren and sisters who are giving their life for it. They're pouring out their life in it. They are possibly unknown, unrecognized, unheralded and unsung outside the local area. But they're pouring out their life for the service of God just before us. That's a great thing. And it's their joy and delight so to do. Bless God for every one of you. Who find your joy and delight as you are summoned to assemble in assembly gatherings to do your bit for God. Paul says, I am pouring out my life as a drink offering. I'll give myself to that. Is that right? Just where you are, is that what you're doing? Have it just a minute. You will notice what he says. He says here, and if I be poured forth as a drink offering, if I be poured, might not be, but if. Do you remember in 2 Timothy 4 when he had reached the end of life? And he's writing his last words from the dungeon. He says this, I am now ready to be poured forth as a drink offering. The time has come when he's actually going to give his life. I want you to notice in each of these occasions, he says, I'm ready to offer my life for it. There came a time when possibly when he knew that his final appeal before Caesar was to be rejected, and within a few days or weeks they'll take him out to the Ostian Way, 3 miles outside the ancient city of Rome, and the blade will flash and he'll be beheaded. He knows that the end of the road has come and he's going to die as a martyr. He views death and he says, I am now ready to be offered. Like his Lord, no man will take his life from him. That's not his viewpoint. He says, I'm going out to offer my life to God. I'm going to pour it out like a burnt offering. I'm happy to die for Christ. I'm happy to give my life. Oh, brethren, there were times when Paul was world weary. He longed for the battle to be over. Longed for the days of the scarring and the beatings to be finished. Long for the days when no longer he would bear in his body the brand marks of Christ for his loyalty. He longed for the sunset. Long for the evening stars. Long for the calm of heaven. Long for the rest that lies on the other side. Oh, brethren, if we work more for Christ, if we were toiling and weary, if we were battle scarred and beaten, I tell you we would long for heaven. Long for him. I am ready to give my life. The hills of Bonnie, Scotland are stained with the blood of the martyrs. Up yonder when men and women, sometimes young men and young women died by fire and water for Christ.
Down yonder in the southwest, in a little town called Wicktown, you can see the grave and the memorial to two women, two sisters, one older, one younger, who died for Christ. If you're up there, down there, go and see. It was decreed they would die by drowning because they would not renege Christ. You know that word, renege, you know. They wouldn't give up their faith and conform to religious tradition that was being forced on them. Just as the tide was about to come in, they tied the older woman to a stake further out, and the younger woman to a stake just near the shore, but looking out at the older woman. And the older woman died, saying, "The masters never seem to die grimly. Oh, I tell you, I've talked to you about setting life and death now, but remember this, you'll get paid to die." She wanted. No doubt about that. She died singing. The younger woman is watching, she's only about 18. Life's sweet, isn't it? Sweet at 58, and that's 18, isn't it? Life's always sweet. The water began to lap about her feet, up to her calves, her knees, her thighs. Still she refused to recant. Up to her breasts, to her neck. As the waters began to go over her head, the soldiers rushed in and they lifted the stake up. They gave her one last chance to renounce your faith. Hope you. She refused. She dies for Christ, to maintain the rights of Christ in his assembly. Paul says, "If I be poor, poor, steep as a master, I joy and rejoice with you all, and I know you'll rejoice with me again." I don't understand, truly, why it is that we are not counted worthy to suffer for Christ. I don't know why most of the suffering should be concentrated in Eastern Europe. Over yonder, the underground church, they tell me, I pray, that the church in the West might be purified by persecution. I tell you, it was in our ranks. But it would leave the gold and the wheat tried with fire. Enough. Verses 19 to 24, Timothy. Paul's going to talk about his fellow servant. In verse 19, he expresses his desire. That's 20. He speaks of Timothy's fitness to help them. Verse 21. He makes a general assessment. All seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ's. Verse 22. He talks about a partnership in the gospel between the Son and the Father. Verse 23, he expresses the desire to send Timothy present. Verse 24, he expresses the hope that he himself will get there. Listen back. Verse 19, I trust in the Lord Jesus. I suppose that's a similar expression to if the Lord will, if the Lord permits. I trust in the Lord to send Timothy shortly, that I may be of good comfort when I know your state. Verse 20, I have no one like-minded who will naturally care for your state. I have no one like-minded who will care with genuine feeling how you get on. Well, that's it. That's it. We're needing men that care. We need men that want to encourage us. Here is Paul the preacher, and he says, I'm sending Timothy, a younger preacher, and he'll care for you. Isn't it remarkable in the gifts that were given by the risen Christ in Ephesians 4? Evangelists, and then it says, pastors, teachers. And by the way, that word pastor is the word for shepherd. It's not a title for a man to take. God never intended a man to be called pastor, so and so. The word means a shepherd. It's not a title in front of your name, it's a work that you do. And he talks there about past shepherd teachers. He's talking about teachers with a shepherd heart. We come to you and we don't know you, but we love you. We want to care for you, we want to help you, with feelings for you. He says, we care with genuine feeling how you're doing as Christians at assemblies. Paul says, there's no one else that can mirror how I feel with him. Now verse 22, we'll come back to verse 21. Verse 22, he's still talking about Timothy. Now he says, you know his proven worth. Is that right? The proof is his proven worth. How that as a son or a child with a father he served with me in the gospel. Now notice please, notice Paul and Timothy preaching together, fellowship between the older and the younger, between the mature man and the one who's not just so mature, between wisdom and understanding in the apostle and zeal and energy in the younger man. Brethren, we're living in a day when they want to divide the old and the young, and it's unscriptural. Come on now. Paul picked up Timothy in Acts 16. For the rest of their life they worked together to show a pattern of service. Because we older ones with experience and wisdom and knowledge need the energetic activity and zeal and enthusiasm of the younger. But the younger with all that needs the guidance of those who are older. So we work together in a sacred fellowship. We keep together. Oh yeah, we feed together. You fed your family at the same table, didn't you? You all ate the same kind of food. I know. I can't talk for you. I can talk about the old country, as you call it. I know lots of assemblies that introduce a ministry meeting for young people to find they don't attend the assembly ministry meeting. That's wrong. Many meetings instituted that weekends the stated gathering, and it's weakening the assembly. When the younger folks in fellowship don't appear at the normal meetings, but appear for the young folks meeting. Clear? He's showing here that there's always a fellowship that remains intact. But he says, what I'm after is this. He says, you know the proof of him. You know his proven. Brothers and sisters, listen. You've got to earn respect. You've got to work for people to admire you. You've got to put it in for people to recognize it. He said, witness the interdoctrinal fellowship that believes certain things, and they are responsible for all the activities, and responsible to gather every gathering, not only to pray prayer. Not only can the assembly be strong and vital, you must prove yourself. You must prove yourself. Come again. Verse 23 and 24 is clear. He says, I'll send Timothy as soon as I know how it will go with me. He says, if they don't release me, I'll send Timothy. But if they do release me, then I'll come along with them. That's good. He's anxious to see them. He's yet. Now please, verse 21. He says now, all seek their own things, not the things which are Jesus Christ. Well, well. That's not that. Now remember this, please. Remember that when I talked to you
about this question of not seeking your own but the things of Christ. You might be prepared to turn round and say, it's all right for you, you're full time and that's your business. So I want you to understand, please, that I didn't enter full time service till 1970. When I ministered in this city in 1967 and 69, I was still working. Took my holidays to come over for 4 or 5 weeks. So you'll understand that I know what it is to work for a living, and I work for a living and preach most of my life. And all things considered, I believe that should be a normal thing. So when I say to you, look at your life and ask yourself the question, would anyone get the impression that what you're seeking is the things of Jesus Christ and you're promoting Christ's interest and not your own? Are you so immersed in your career, or at your work, or in your hobby? Would these things take up more time than you give to Christ? Say, I apply it to Eglinton because I'm here. You apply it where you are. Eglinton is only one midweek meeting, isn't that right? On a Tuesday night, you gather for, I take it, prayer and Bible reading. The meeting will begin at 8 o'clock, finish it, 9:30. I wonder how many in fellowship in Eglinton can't spare an hour and a half out of 6 days from Monday to Saturday. Can't give an hour and a half to the Lord. Who demands the collective gathering of sheep on a taking application for you are. Now, when he says, all seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ, I don't think he's giving a sweeping condemnation. I don't think so. I think what he's saying is, look out. It's a rare thing to find a person completely devoted to Christ. It's a rare thing to find the sweet savour of consecrated living. But so many Christians are out. That's what he's saying. But he says, listen, in the ultimate and in the end, the things of Jesus Christ are what counts. To work for a living and to pay the expenses. The rest of the time you devote to the interest of the man that gave his life for you and lives in heaven. Enough. Verse 25. 25 to 30, Epaphroditus. We don't know him so well. But Timothy. Verse 25, you have his character. For that. Verses 26 to 28, Paul gives reasons for sending him back to Philippi. Verses 29 and 30, he's concerned with the reception that he'll receive and how he should be treated when he gets back home. Now, verse 25. Now he says, listen, I'm sending Epaphroditus back. Now Epaphroditus was the person, the brother, who carried the gift of Philippi to Rome personally, a distance of approximately 700 miles. You can just think how long it took for express trains, no jumbo jets. He carried that sacred deposit to give it. I'll touch on this when I do chapter 4 on the closing night, next Wednesday of the Lord. Now he says, I'm sending him back. But he describes them now. You will notice 5 qualities that belong to Epaphroditus. 3 of them in relation to Paul, 2 that describe Epaphroditus. Paul says, he is my brother, my fellow laborer, as it should be, and my fellow soldier. My brother, that's a term of relationship and affection.
my fellow laborer. So he's the person that works side by side, laboring in the gospel. He is my fellow soldier. So he has taken up arms for Christ. He was serving Christ on the battlefield and not in the training yard. He's not on parade. He's right in the midst of the battle. My brother. I like that. Relationship. Fellowship. I was once very touched about this verse. Way back yonder in end of August 1970, the assembly in Kilmarnock, in association with other assemblies, held a gathering in order to fit the blessing of God upon me. They invited one or two brethren to speak. And one of them was our brother Gooding, that you know, we call him AMS. And when he rose that day, this is the verse. He said, for we have preached together often, even for a number of weeks on occasions in the gospel. It was very touching when he began to speak of my brother, my fellow laborer, my fellow soldier. That intimacy of relationship between us continues cordially and warmly to this day. There's no man I admire. My fellow laborer. This is Paul about this man. This was the brother that had learned to live and work with somebody else. It's easy working your own, you know. You can just do what you like, so to speak, you understand. When you have to work with someone else and be disciplined, and very often submit your mind to the others, very difficult. You know that. You find that even in assembly life, very difficult to live with each other. They didn't learn very much about it at Corinth, and we haven't learned a great deal about it either, do we? Fellow souls. That's right. But he says, notice that, please. My messenger. And he that ministered to my wants. Now that word messenger is the word for apostle. But as I told you, there are only 13 official apostles, so now it's used in its secondary sense as a messenger. He said, he's the man that came to me. It was your messenger. You sent him. He came in all the dignity of an ambassador for Christ. But he says he's the man that ministered to my wants. I like that. Just to do the ordinary. Just to do the common. Just to be beside Paul and meet his needs wherever way he wishes. And that's good. We can't all be preachers. The spotlight can't shine upon everybody publicly. Just as great a reward for Epaphroditus if he did it and did it well as for Paul. Is that right? Didn't the man with the two talents get the same reward correspondingly as the man with the five? Come on. Come on. Not my fault, brother, if I've only two talents and you five. That's not my fault. That's sovereignty. That's the way God ordered it. But if I use my two talents to the full, I'll get the same reward as you when you use your five. What that? That's a big encouragement, isn't it? Come again. Verses 26 to 28, he's sending them back. Now verses 26 and 27, his first reason is because Epaphroditus was longing after him. He was homesick. He was very ill. Huh? Verse 28. He says, I sent him diligently, carefully, quickly, for your sake, that you might rejoice when you see him. Finally, he says, I sent him for my sake, that I may be the less sorrowful.
are still of the sort of imprisonment. But less worry now that I know that she's wholly faithful to you. Come again. Verse 26, 27, he longed after you all and was full of heaviness, full of distress, because he had heard that he had been sick. He was worried about them worrying about him. Aye, that's good, isn't it? Verse 27. He said he was sick nigh unto death, but God had mercy on him. And not on him only, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. That is, he had the sorrow of imprisonment, but he didn't want the sorrow of Epaphroditus dying so. Alright? Now, so he says, I sent him to you. I'll come back to that. Well, you'll leave verse 26 for a moment, please. Now, quickly. Verses 28, 29 and 30. Now he says, you receive him with gladness. Hold him in honor. Give him a place of reputation. Because for the work of Christ he was nigh unto death, pouring out his life to supply your lack of service for me. That is, to supply what you couldn't supply because you were so far away. So that they didn't want to serve Paul, but he was doing it on their behalf. And doing it on their behalf as a messenger, he had given himself so utterly to it that he had reached well nigh the portals of death. Finally, as I draw to a close, note please, will you, that all sickness is not because of sin. Notice please too, verse 27, he was nigh unto death, but God had mercy on him, so it was the mercy of God that healed him, not Paul. Indicating that God does not always miraculously heal. Now my time's up for you. I would like to have spoken to you on chastening. To show you that all sickness is not due to sin. For instance, chastening comes in three ways. It can be retributive. You can suffer for your sins. David is the example. Chastening can be educated. The example is Job. Chastening can be preventative. The example is Paul. He had a thorn in the flesh. He was humble. Am I right? It's perfectly clear, as time went on, that not even Paul was healing in every circumstance. For instance, Timothy had a weak stomach, 1 Timothy 5, Paul didn't heal him. Paul had a thorn in the flesh that was physical that God gave to keep him humble, no one would be allowed to heal it. Epaphroditus was sick nigh unto death, so Paul never healed him. 2 Timothy 4, Trophimus have I left that my leave him sick. Paul never healed them. It's not God's mind always to heal. There are deep lessons to be learned along the line of suffering. Understand? So may the Lord